Good morning, Wasatch back, and happy Wednesday. It's 8:06 a.m., and you are listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Jennifer Dobner, filling in for your regular host, Leslie Thatcher. And we've got a great hour ahead, but first, let's check in with ABC4's Cedric Haynes for a look at Wasatch back weather. Here's hoping he's got some rain in the forecast to quell Utah's fires.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Wednesday, hump day. We're tracking scattered showers and thunderstorms. Now, it's not going to rain all day, but it will be a chance of scattered showers and storms rolling through the area. So make sure that you take the rain gear with you as you make your way out throughout the day. Temperatures will be cooler with the extra cloud cover and the chance of those scattered showers and storms. So high temperatures in Park City will struggle to get out of the upper 70s to near 80. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, we're talking high temperatures only in the mid 80s. For us today. So definitely a cooling trend showing up in that forecast. As we make our way into your Thursday, well, showers and thunderstorms become likely. Thursday could be a fairly wet day across most of the Beehive State. So again, make sure you have that rain gear close by and watch out for that isolated potential of a little flash flooding in some spots. That's going to be something we're going to monitor carefully, particularly near any area local burn scars that we may have in the region. Temperatures for highs in Park City on your Thursday, we're talking only low 70s as it goes throughout your Thursday afternoon. What a big change heading our way. High temperatures will struggle to hit 80 degrees in the Heber Valley with those extra clouds and that chance of scattered showers and storms. If you like Thursday, you'll like Friday. Another good chance of those scattered showers and storms out there across the area. Temperatures, because of the clouds and the rain chances, held down mid-70s, low to mid-70s for us in Park City, with highs only around 80 again in the Heber Valley. As we move into the weekend, we will start to notice a drier trend. Still a chance of a few isolated storms on our Saturday. Temperatures will jump back into the mid-70s for highs in Park City. We'll be in the low 80s for highs in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Sunday, that's when we're expecting a mixture of clouds and sunshine. Temperatures will be in the upper 70s, and Park City will be in the low 80s in the Heber Valley. As we move into next week, well, it's going to be overall drier. Just a very slight chance of a pop-up storm early next week. High temperatures will be only around 80 degrees in Park City, with highs still in the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. That's a good latest forecast for the Wasatch back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, we'll hear from Park City Community Foundation Climate Fund manager Victoria Schlafer and James Dumas, head chef and owner at The Alpinist. They're going to talk about the Zero Food Waste Initiative and the Chef's Table event coming to Park City next week. Then Park City Manager Adam Leonard and Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden will stop by with a look at this week's council meeting agenda. That will be followed by Heber Valley Chamber Public Relations Manager Jessica Turner, who has the lowdown on what's happening across the Heber Valley this month. After that, stay tuned for the Mountain Life at 9 o'clock. A baby once treated by a local chiropractor, Dr. Christine Phillips, grew up to become her chiropractic partner. Together, Phillips and Dr. Rachel Santa Maria explore how movement, alignment, and whole body care can support lifelong health. Then, after a traumatic brain injury ended her X Games career, Park City's Jamie Mocrazy climbed Mount Kilimanjaro with her mom to prove that resilience can take you to extraordinary heights. Let's check in with some local news. A resident group says about 2,000 people have signed a petition opposing Park City's plans to redevelop a vacant lot in the middle of town. KPCW's Thomas reports they want more park and less city.
Place PC plans to submit its petition to the Park City Council Thursday, opposing the current trajectory for the Bonanza Park 5-acre site. The city-owned land at Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive has a shuttered gas station and is otherwise bare. Park City Municipal bought it in 2017 with the hope of creating an arts and culture district. Almost a decade later, the City Council has selected a design by Brinshore Development with a mix of housing and park space. Place PC is advocating for more park, less city, a tagline it has put on t-shirts and yard signs. The group has proposed alternative designs on its website. Group member Tom Seitz says the city needs to take a pause.
Once we saw physically what it looked like and what was being proposed and the way in which it was being funded, et cetera, we started asking questions about it, and we were reinforced, if you will, by the significant number of people that came to us and in the case of our petition drive, sign the petition in order to say, wait a second, we had no idea this was about to happen.
Park City is contributing up to $40 million from hotel room sales taxes to split the cost of development with Brinshore. Wednesday is the first of at least two public hearings the Park City Planning Commission has scheduled for the project. It would be up to the council to reverse course on its March 2026 decision to move forward with the Brinshore plans. So that's who Place PC plans to address on Thursday. Of the estimated 2,000 people who signed the petition, Place PC's Kelly Pfaff says the majority are Park City residents. Some who signed it at the Market grocery store were from elsewhere in Summit County or Salt Lake City. Pfaff says they're all spending money in Park City and are united by an appreciation for natural beauty and mountain views. The height of the five-acre project is one of Place PC's biggest concerns.
We're realizing actually a lot of people don't know about the project. And so it's been nice to be that information piece for them, showing what the city's been doing with it. So we've had a lot more support than we were even realizing we were going to get.
Project supporters contend it delivers on many of the things that petitioners want.
We call on the city council to pursue a different vision on the site, a public park for park guides, a central gathering place for recreation, local arts, municipal use, and community enjoyment.
About 2 acres in the middle of the 106 proposed residential units will remain open, with a small amphitheater, playground, and lawn space. The majority of the residences, 88, would be affordable, and there would be commercial spaces on the ground floor of each building. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
We're going to give you a little update now on the Rocky Canyon fire. There's a bit of new news about the acreage and containment. Just a reminder, it's burning in Summit County and Morgan County, and it has forced over 500 people to evacuate, including most of the town of Hennifer. This morning, the update is that it's reached 15,300 acres and at 25% containment. Officials say it's a human caused, although the specifics remain under investigation. Structures are threatened in the Hennifer area, but none have yet been reported lost. That's a little unclear in some of the harder to reach areas, and no reports of livestock losses. The evacuation area is west of Main Street in Hennifer to the Summit Morgan County line between East Canyon Road and South Hennifer Road. Areas on set status, which means get ready to go if you have to, are Hennifer east of Main Street, Franklin Canyon to Icy Springs Wahali Way area, which is on the western edge of Colville. And we'll be getting an update about 9 o'clock this morning from fire officials, and we will share with you what we learn. And remember, you can always find the latest on wildfire evacuations and road closures at kpcw.org and on the KPCW app. Okay, this morning we're happy to have with you, we're going to talk about the inaugural Chef's Table Festival, which is coming to Park City next week, along with 70 of the world's most celebrated chefs. The festival has also teamed up with the Park City Community Foundation's Zero Food Waste Diversion Initiative to make sure that the event is both delicious and sustainable. So joining me now are Park City Community Foundation Climate Fund Manager Victoria Schleffer, and James Dumas, head chef over at the Alpinist. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
So I didn't know anything about the Chef's Table event. So for other people like me, tell me, what kind of experience is this?
Yeah, Jennifer, thanks. And Victoria, good morning. It is a pretty exciting event. They're bringing in close to 100 chefs, and they've paired up with restaurants, hotels throughout the whole town. And there's chefs from around the world. We're super excited. We're hosting 7 chefs in 3 nights, 60 covers a night, so 60 dinners a night, 5 courses, so 300 plates.
That seems like a lot.
It is, with a whole new team. Tomorrow night, we're hosting 3 chefs, 1 from Japan, 1 from Peru, and 1 from Malaysia. And they brought 3 chefs in with them. So our team triples in size. Friday night with the Park City Foundation, we have 2 female chefs coming in from Colombia and Dominican Republic. and we're super excited to host that. I think, Victoria, we're completely sold out on that one, or close to it, is what I've heard. And then on the final night, I'm super excited for, especially because it sort of fits to the alpinist, is we have a chef from Tibet and a chef from India on either side at the same elevation. So that'll be a fun one. And then all three nights we're hosting a vintner from Red Hawk Wines that we'll be pairing the whole meal with.
So I misspoke. It's actually this week.
It's this week.
13th to the 16th. Yep. That's correct. Apologize for that. And I understand it's also a bit of a special celebration. It is like marking the anniversary of the Chef's Table.
The series on
Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how does this all come together? Like, who's the mastermind behind the table or in the kitchen?
Netflix mm-hmm. sort of approach came to the town, and from what I've heard, it's a multi-year contract that they're going to be in. This is the inaugural one, so we're all trying to work out all the kinks and whatnot, but it could be the summer Sundance program, which would be pretty cool.
Well, it's making me hungry just thinking about it. Talk about, so is this like a behind-the-scenes thing where you can interact with chefs, you can watch the kitchen activity?
I think it depends on the restaurant. Mm-hmm. We do have a chef's table in our kitchen, mm-hmm. and it's sort of a visible kitchen, but we will be on the floor, so it will be interactive.
And five-course meals, and the chefs come together and mm-hmm. plan all that,
yeah.
and they're coming from somewhere else into somebody else's kitchen, so how does that complicate things?
It doesn't. It's such a small world, right?
I mean, I guess the pieces are all the same, right? There's a stove, there's a fridge, okay.
Yeah.
And it's not really a traditional food festival, because there are some, like, outdoor activities and hands-on culinary events.
Correct, yeah, there's an event. Actually, one of my mentors that got me into cooking is from Argentina, Francis Malman, and he is sort of the grandfather of cooking, you know, Argentinian cooking, just wildfire and wild table type settings, and he's doing something at Silver Lake on Saturday, mm-hmm. which would be really neat to see.
So let's talk about who are the participating restaurants in town. Do you know off the top of your head?
I don't know
off the top of your head?
I know some of them.
Okay.
Off the top of my head, Firewood, Handle, Deer Valley's participating through Silver Lake. We obviously, there's Alpinist, and then just various other restaurants throughout town. So, you know, while James described the few dinners that they're hosting, there's also a ton of dinners everywhere else throughout Park City this weekend.
And so if I'm a ticket holder, do I choose which restaurant I want to dine at? And is that, you know, which chefs as well?
Yeah, they've been selling packages, and so those include, you know, there's a certain number of dinners and lunches, and you tell the concierge team, which chefs you want to go to, and then they kind of build out a custom itinerary mm-hmm. based on all of that stuff. Yeah.
And can you share any names of, are there chef names that we would know?
Francis Malman, Nancy Silverton, mm-hmm. La Brea. Ours are super fun, but you're sort of young and upcoming, but mm-hmm. they have all Michelin stars, which mm-hmm. is...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The level of professionalism is really... I trained in Switzerland, so seeing that level come back into town, you know, our workforce here is sort of younger, so we're all trying to teach them, and having these sort of groups come in and have our kitchen team work with them and see it sort of raises the bar, which is really cool.
Levels up their skills.
It's really neat.
It must be also very exciting.
And they're super excited.
Yeah.
And nervous. Right?
Yeah, okay, good.
Both. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the cool things for the dinner that we're hosting at Alpinist with Park City Community Foundation, you know, as chefs travel throughout the world, I feel like they all have sustainability practices back at home in their restaurants. And Jaime Rodriguez, who's one of the chefs on Friday night, is a great example of that. He's listed in the top 50 most sustainable restaurants in Latin America. And so being able to partner with Chef's Table Festival to bring food waste diversion to the festival and make sure as these chefs are traveling, they're not kind of compromising on their sustainability ethics is been a really fun project
to see
come to life.
So let's talk a little bit about the Park City Community Foundation's Zero Food Waste Initiative. It's been going since 2024, is that right, or earlier?
Yeah, 2024.
2024. So let's remind people what it is.
Yeah, great question. So, You know, Park City Community Foundation is focused on solving our area's greatest challenges, and one of those is climate change. And we chose to focus on zero food waste because our landfill is set to fill in 2053, and we won't permit another landfill in Summit County after that. So the goal of diverting food waste is right now, currently almost half of what goes to the landfill is food waste. And so if we can continue to pull food waste out of the landfill, it reduces the amount of methane coming out of the landfill and also frees up space so that we can extend the life of the landfill.
And so this partnership will extend that effort for the community.
Exactly. Yeah, right now we're focused on growing business food waste diversion. And so this partnership with Chef's Table is allowing us to set up food waste diversion with Alpinist, which is going to be exciting, and a couple other restaurants as well. So over half the participating restaurants through Chef's Table Festival will have food waste diversion as part of their program.
And is there a growing movement within the food service industry in general to be more sustainable? I think I was reading that in 2024, it generated about 12.5 tons of surplus food, and that nearly 85% of it went to landfills.
Yeah, there's a big movement, I think, across the United States right now to start helping people understand how they can reduce wasted food. I believe, you know, in households, people waste around like $700 in food a year just by food going bad. And so there's a movement to help people understand how they can waste less food, as well as how they can then, if they are going to have food left over, divert that from landfills.
Talk about your kitchen experience with food waste. I mean, what was traditionally done, and how are you moving in a new direction?
Yeah, no, thanks. That's a great question. It actually sparked some memories coming in here that I shared with Victoria. Two special ones were in Switzerland. The farmers would always come to the kitchen. So the produce, the pork, the meat, they would come in the vans, but they'd also bring us a clean, empty bucket for any of the waste, and they would always share. So it went back into either compost or back as feed. High West, we partnered with Gold Creek Farms, with Fernando, the cheesemaker. And we would bring 250 gallons of stillage. So stillage was the spent whiskey process. And we'd bring it to the cows, and they would actually run. We had them that they were starting to run to the truck when they would see the truck come up. They were happy cows, right? And Fernando's like, hey, happy cows make
delicious cheese.
Well, but it did. It raised their protein content
and
the milk yield, right? So it was neat. But to see this go into, to really pull it out of a landfill and whatnot, I mean, our goal in the kitchen is minimal waste, right? So we're always tracking. And it brings back this whole process of you're not going right into the garbage can. You know, if it's anything edible or compostable, it will be in a bucket on the table as you're prepping.
And can you talk a little bit about in the Park City community among restaurants, is that a general trend, or are you all talking about it with each other?
I mean, we're so busy, right?
Oh, for sure.
You're right, and it's, I mean, I know what we do, and we're always being conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think this is a great program. And we were just chatting about how to make it more operational in the high stress point of the evening, right? It's, so you just need it comes down to the setup.
So tell me a little bit more about that. That's like a bucket or some other.
Well, they have containers, but you want to make sure that, you know, they're going to the right spot. It's a step in the process, right? Versus when you're clearing tables, the servers and bussers want to get back out on the floor. So it has to be streamlined in the process. And we're going to test it. We're going to test it this week.
Because you have a great community partner here.
We do. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So tell me, what do people need to know? How do you still get tickets? Where do you get more information?
Yeah, so for our fundraising dinner that we're partnering with the Alpinist on Friday, you can find, we still have a few tickets left at parkcitycf.org under our events page. People can buy tickets there. And if you're just interested in food waste diversion and helping us expand that within Summit County, Park City Community Foundation Zero Food Waste Initiative is a great place to support the efforts going even further after this weekend.
And can you say, like, the ticket prices range from what to what?
Yeah, ticket prices right now are $550 for the meal. That includes the wine pairing with Red Hawk Vineyards. And then if you don't want the wine pairing, the ticket is $475.
Okay. Anything else you want us to know?
No, just get out and enjoy it. I mean, it's some good culinary energy coming into town, which is, it was fun to see.
Well, I'm going to be out of town, but I want you to save me some leftovers. Okay. So we've been speaking with Park City Community Foundation's Climate Fund Manager, Victoria Schleifer. Good, I got it. And James Dumas, head chef and owner of The Alpinist, about the Chef's Table Dining Extravaganza this weekend. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Yep. Here's another look at some local news. For the first time in around a decade, Park City High School is teaching students how to drive. KPCW's Christine Weller reports school district leaders wanted to make driver's education more accessible.
Park City High School students can soon hit the road in Park City School District's newly acquired Chevrolet Equinox, along with an instructor. Career and Technical Education Director Tracy Fike said it's the first time in about 10 years the district has offered a driver's ed program.
It's been offered on and off for many years previous to that, but we haven't had the program here in Park City, so students had to go private or go down to Salt Lake or find other school districts that offer the program.
Fike said it can be difficult to find driver's ed teachers. The certification takes at least 6 months to acquire. That's why she's contracted with two teachers involved in South Summit and Wasatch County School District programs. Students must already have a learner's permit to sign up. The online curriculum takes about 30 hours to complete. Then, students drive with an instructor for about 5 hours. Fike said the high school's program costs $470, but there are fee waivers for qualifying students.
Locally, it's over $700 to take private driver's ed lessons, but by providing it through the high school, we can do fee waivers for students who are eligible for them.
Fike said 35 students have already enrolled in the course. She's hoping to add a third instructor to the team so there are more opportunities for the kids to get behind the wheel. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
In the studio with us now, we have Park City Manager Adam Lenhard and Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden with a look at this week's City Council meeting agenda. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome back
to council meetings. I know they had a little break.
Thank you.
But it's back to business now, so no sloughing, right? Before we get into the agenda, I wanted to ask you about the Rocky Mountain Fire emergency alert that went out over the weekend. There were some problems with that. Summit County officials mentioned Park City Municipal as being part of that situation over the weekend. I wanted to give you a chance to tell us what exactly happened on the Park City end.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know that the message going out in error obviously was unfortunate. We've looked at that as an opportunity to learn. And one positive takeaway for us was that this really became a valuable real-world exercise and an opportunity to test ourselves in a way. It raises some really important questions. First of all, what if it had been real? Were we ready? And then secondly, how do we learn from this to improve our response to the community? And we're approaching this from two different angles. We're saying internally at Park City Municipal, how do we ensure that across our organization, all of our departments understand their roles and responsibilities during a natural disaster or emergency? Are they ready to respond? I was really encouraged by what I saw behind the scenes here in Park City in terms of the response. I happened to be on Main Street when we got the alert, and it was interesting to look around and kind of see how people were responding. And immediately, within seconds of that message going out, the communications began. The mayor and council were activated right away. They were already participating, communicating, saying, what do we do? How do we help? What's next? So that was encouraging to see. And then internally with our staff, right away, big response, everybody calling, texting, strategizing, getting ready, everybody being ready to work. Of course, in a situation like this, we want to learn, like I said, and we have had some really great meetings so far this week to debrief, kind of look at what happened, understand You know, on the message side, I'm not sure it's so important to say, hey, who pushed that button and, you know, in error, right? But what do we learn from it? Now what? How do we make sure that next time we're prepared? And like I said, it gave us an opportunity to really look at our respective roles during an emergency and how that information flows. And our goal is simple. When there is a public safety emergency in Park City, we want to be ready. Two angles, like I said, how we're approaching this internally. How is Park City Municipal going to respond? Are we ready? But then another component of that would be the community education piece. And so I want to highlight to our listeners that the city has a great resource available online. It's BeReadyParkCity.org. It's a simple Google search, Be Ready Park City, or that URL. And on that website, there are some really great resources. I took the opportunity to jump on there, pull up the various documents. Even with our kids, we were going through the checklist of if you have to evacuate, you know, what are the various steps. So there's some really good information on there. We do have an evacuation plan. We do have a lot of those resources in place. So we would encourage our listeners to jump on the website, make sure that we're all ready collectively, both individually and then, you know, as a community.
So did you have a go bag before, or do you just have one now?
I do, but what was interesting is to like open it up and realize, oh, some of this stuff I probably don't need anymore, or it ought to be replaced. So yeah, some great lessons, some great takeaways.
Is Park City on the same emergency management communication system as the county? And I think that's a government-based mm-hmm. system,
yes,
as
sir.
Opposed to like, is it Everbridge? That mm-hmm. that other communities use?
Everbridge is the system that does the notifications. Mm-hmm. They're contracted, they have the ability to send those messages. Yes, we're all in that same system. And then in terms of like radio communications, because you can't always rely on your cell phones during an emergency, you know,
if we
lose signal. So those radios are very reliable. It's a redundant communication system, and we all operate on the same frequency statewide and with our public safety.
And, of course, KPCW is on your first call list to help you
absolutely.
Get the information out.
And thank you for the role that KPCW played, because we were able to get some messaging out to the public very quickly, and that was really valuable.
Well, that is one of our commitments to the community, is to be that kind of resource. I notice on the agenda, shifting to the agenda, that council is going to be getting an update from staff on a proposal for a regional emergency communications center. So that seems like something that would have been great to have on Sunday, but also it costs money and it's complicated and interlocal agreements and all those things. But tell us what the conversation is and what's being considered.
Yeah, you know, the timing is very interesting. When we put this on the agenda, or internally when we first started saying, hey, let's present this idea to the council, the Rocky Canyon Fire was not going, so the timing there, I think now is the right time, certainly. But our initial assessment is that a regional public safety facility could certainly have some benefit to our community in terms of public safety and disaster response. And any time that we have an opportunity to look at our operations and how well we're working with our partners in the community, the county, the fire district, who we appreciate so much and have a great partnership with. But anytime we have an opportunity to look at that and see if we can improve, then let's take that opportunity. But like I said, it's at this stage just our initial internal assessment. We think there could be some benefits. And we say in a facility like this, there are some potential functions that could include emergency operations, incident command, emergency supply distribution, family reunification, triage, staging, public safety training, multi-jurisdictional coordination. There's so much, right? The list goes on and on. We think it's a topic worth discussing, but there are a lot of questions around this. Are those benefits real? We think so, but let's test it. Let's look at it. Where would it be located? How big would it be? How much would it cost? And how would we pay
for it? Who's going to pay for it, yeah.
And which agencies would be involved? None of those questions have been answered. It's the point of this is just to present the idea to council, get some feedback and direction. If it turns out that there's a consensus that, hey, this is an idea worth exploring with our partners, or our regional partners, then let's start looking into it.
So in theory, it would be like one location where all the players would be involved in a critical incident, so that people would be in the same room at the same time to streamline communications, getting the information out
with as few mishaps as possible.
Absolutely.
And I imagine a big electronic board where
probably
you can see all the
pieces.
A lot of
screens.
Yeah. But
that's the idea. Again, we would want to test that and make sure that those benefits to the public are real, that it's worth pursuing. And again, with respect to, you know, location and who might be involved there, very open-ended at this point. And you know, the feedback from our partners and stakeholders is very important in deciding how we move forward.
So it sounds like this would also be an important part of planning and execution of the Olympic and Paralympic events that we'll have when the Games come to this area in 2034.
I think a facility like this could absolutely have a key role there. Even setting the question of the Olympics aside, I think it's still probably worth looking at and exploring for the potential benefits. But if a facility were up and running in time for the Olympics, I'm certain we would use it.
Well, also wildfires are probably not going away.
Probably not. Yeah. If I could, right before we came on air, I got a note from my team and something I wanted to pass along. Right now, this morning at the Mark, we have some community volunteers who were set up right outside, and they are collecting thank you notes to our first responders. We're really appreciative of those who are out working the fire and have been over the past few days. So if you're interested at all in writing a little thank you note to those first responders, those volunteers are going to be at the Mark until 11 a.m. today. And then those notes that we collect from the community are going to go into some prepackaged lunches that will be taken on site to those who are responding to the fire. So I just wanted to plug that.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. It's a really tough job they have out there, and I'm sure they appreciate it. So please keep us posted, though, on that Emergency Operations
Absolutely.
Center conversation, because I think people would be interested in knowing how that's playing out. So let's move on to the rest of the agenda. First, I want to talk about Little Kate Road. The council's being asked to advance the project to a final design stage. And what does that look like now, and how does it reflect the public input that you've received?
Yes, as you know, we've received a lot of public engagement on this issue, a lot of interested residents in how the design is coming forward on Little Kate, and we have really taken stock of that communication from the public and what they really want to see. We know one of the big concerns was the intersection of bikes and pedestrians on a multi-use path, and concerns from residents about, you know, potential e-bikes and what that might cause on our initial design. So the new strategy, once we have taken that input from the public, is to present some alternative options that really separate bicyclists from pedestrians. And so there are a few different options that are being proposed, but the one that staff is recommending to the council tomorrow is painted buffered bike lanes that would be on each side of the road, separating them to a degree by painted lines from the roadway, and then a slightly expanded sidewalk, along with some traffic calming improvements that they are proposing that the council consider. And some of those traffic calming options that are going to be discussed are some curb extensions, median islands, traffic circles, raised crosswalks and intersections, and some speed tables for the council to consider. Now, all of those have some potential maintenance impacts, and so those are the things that the council will be weighing as they consider those. We're also looking at some additional safety enhancements along Little Kate. Those include potentially some green bicycle lane paint, some safe routes to school pavement markings, some speed feedback signs, and potentially high visibility crosswalk markings. So those are all going to be considered by the council.
Can you tell me a little bit more about some of those traffic calming things? Like, I don't really know what a speed table is. And although I live in a neighborhood in Salt Lake where we have these like half circles, half moons that come now off the curb into the road, I think some people in my neighborhood think that's like a game, but I'm not sure it's, but tell me what these different things are and what they're expected to do.
Yeah, I will give you my best attempt.
Okay.
So I hope you'll bear with me.
I know you're not the traffic staff.
Yes, so. I will say I would direct anyone who's really interested in these options to take a look at Exhibit C to the staff report. This mm-hmm. has some actual visuals of these traffic calming options. So there's curb extensions that would bring a curb out, you know, closer to the roadway. There's ones that allow kind of for a bike bypass. There's a median island where it's almost like an island in the roadway mm-hmm. that would narrow the roadway lanes, that tends to calm traffic because it slows drivers down. there, you know, a traffic circle would be in an intersection where, you know, a circle in the middle of the intersection mm-hmm. requires, you know, people to utilize it as more of a roundabout. And then there's, you know, raised crosswalks that would act like kind of a larger speed bump that tends to also slow traffic down. And a raised intersection could be the entire middle of an intersection is raised a little bit. So it kind of operates similarly to a raised crosswalk where the entire kind of like square center of the intersection mm-hmm. is raised a little bit mm-hmm. to calm traffic through there. And then a speed table is similar in that it's sort of a, you know, a larger kind of
a snowplow friendly speed bump.
Oh yeah, exactly. Well, we do need those. Yeah. So those are the things that are, you know, potential options for the council to consider. And as Adam mentioned, it really is considering what's going to work in our community and what's going to allow snow plowing and maintenance and snow storage in a way that's going to continue to work through the winter.
And so they're hoping to get direction on one of those proposals tonight
correct.
To move
correct.
Forward.
Yes.
And then if that happens, then when would work start? Do we know?
The next step would be continuing to refine the design process. Mm-hmm. And the idea would be that when we reach about 60% design, we would have further opportunities for public input on those final designs. And then we would take those designs with the public input back to the City Council, probably later in the year, November, December timeframe, for the final confirmation of the plans for locate.
Okay, well, let's move on to a different part of the transportation conversation, and that is you're getting there'll be a semi-annual report on the transportation demand management. And I was looking at the staff report, and it looks like more and more people are choosing to get out of their cars. And there's lots of different ways to do that, vanpools and mm-hmm. other options, but what does the data tell us about people getting out of their cars first and foremost?
We have some really great numbers. Our transportation demand management programs have three goals: reduce single occupancy vehicle trips, lower transportation related emissions, and improve regional traffic conditions. So this past winter we ran three concurrent initiatives: the Vanpool pilot program, Ride On Winter Rewards, and use of the transit app. And for the sake of time, we'll just encourage those who are interested to attend the meeting, look at the staff report. But the numbers are really encouraging. On the Vanpool pilot, over 9,000 passenger trips saved, 357,000 vehicle miles that were not driven on our streets through this pilot program. And the other initiatives had some great results as well. People choosing alternative and sustainable travel. That's great to see, and so we want to report this back to the council and assess which of these initiatives are worth pursuing.
And that's a partnership with UTA and also with local businesses, is that right?
That's correct. The Vanpool pilot was a partnership, and shout out to those partners, UTA and Summit County, where we all work together to approach this employee shuttle essentially. The employers kicked in to cover some of the cost and coordinate the travel itself, the riders. But yeah, that was a partnership that worked really well. We're excited about that.
And what was do you have a monthly cost on that for the city?
No, I don't. That's a great question. Let me look into that for
you. Okay, thanks. And so it was a pilot for this past winter, but do you think that the results suggest that this is something that would move forward into a more permanent program?
Based on the results that we see, it certainly had a great, you know, a great effect on vehicle miles traveled. We're encouraged by what we see. I do have a note here that the entire pilot was funded 100% from the transportation sales tax. So I'll make that note. But yes, I think the recommendation from staff is that it's worth continuing. All of these initiatives would be.
Okay, we are sort of running out of time, but I did want to give you a chance to tell us about the May tax report and what it tells us about how things are going.
Absolutely, and the reason our sales tax, again, is so important in Park City is because it constitutes a disproportionately large part of our overall budget. We rely very heavily on sales tax. May is historically the city's smallest sales tax month. It only represents about 4% of the total annual sales tax revenue. So very small month. It was a positive, I would call it an encouraging signal as we head into summer. We knew March was just a very, very bad month. But what we've seen, and here's the takeaway, and I think it reflects the resiliency of our local economy, though we still have ongoing concerns. But citywide, fiscal year 26 to date, we're down about 4.2%. So this is from July 1 of last year through May of this year. We're only down about 4%. And given how bad the winter was overall, I think I would have expected to see that overall year-over-year number to be a much bigger drop. So mm-hmm. we're encouraged by that. It certainly, you know, everybody felt the pain throughout the winter. But at least year over year, there are some encouraging signs.
And is there any projection for recovery? Do we think things are coming back? I think when we last heard from the that the bookings were going up for the fall.
TRT the transient room tax or lodging tax is showing some really encouraging signs. In fact, in terms of TRT, this May was one of probably the highest May we've had in a number of years. Mm-hmm. So that's an encouraging sign.
Okay, I'm going to let you go back to your real lives, gearing up for that meeting tomorrow night. And we appreciate you coming, as always.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Okay, and we're wrapping the hour right now with Heber Valley Chamber Public Relations Manager Jessica Turner. Jessica always has the lowdown on what is happening in the Heber Valley. Welcome, Jessica. How are you?
Hi, good morning. I'm well. How are you?
I am well. So it looks like the fun never slows down over there.
That's true.
Tell us. That's great. Tell us about events you have coming up.
Yeah, I just selected some highlights from our pretty robust events calendar, which is ongoing throughout the year. So some of those highlights include, of course, the continued Heber Market on Main happening every Thursday. We've got the two final weeks of the season. It kicks off in June and ends in August. So tomorrow from 5 to 9 at the Heber City Park, and next week on Thursday from 5 to 9 at the Heber City Park. And that will be the last two of the season. So if you've either been and want to go again or you haven't been yet this summer, these will be the last 2 weeks to catch that. And then heading into this weekend, on Saturday, we have the return of the annual Mustang and All Ford Car Show. Now, this is a free car show to attend. It is also held at the Heber City Park. Kicks off at 10 a.m. and goes all day until about 4 p.m., It's a great opportunity to walk through all of these beautifully preserved and many of them overhauled and completely redone vehicles, meet the owners, talk with the enthusiasts. There'll be food trucks. There'll be some live music happening, announcers from the stage. Just a really family-friendly event happening here at Heber City Park. And then heading into next week on August 22nd, so that'll be another Saturday coming up, we've got a John Denver tribute concert happening at the Avon Theater. Now, Avon is owned by a local family, both Avon and Ideal. This local family bought both of those theaters. They renovated them, gave them a major facelift, including some of the acoustics and the AV on the interiors. And they just reopened the Avon Theater earlier this summer. So they have started off with a series of movies and live performances and tribute concerts. And so this will be one of many happening this summer season. So if you're a John Denver fan, you're going to want to catch that on August 22nd at 5 and 7:30. They do two showings in the same day. So back to back, either the early bird time or catch the later show at 7:30. And then new to the railroad this year for 2026 is a wine and cheese train. They were able to secure their serving license and their alcohol license at the Heber Valley Railroad. And they've introduced wine and cheese pairing trains. They've got a sommelier on staff they've hired to come in for these trains specifically. Of course, you do need to be 21 and up to do the tasting and be on that car in the train. It is a 2-hour out and back from 7 to 9 p.m. Great date night, fun adult friend group activity. Overall, just a really pleasant experience. So if you haven't been on the train in a while or if you're looking for something unique, this might just fit the bill. Then we've got a couple of music festivals and a couple of races coming up. So the next music festival will be out at Wallsburg, happening the weekend of August 28th through the 30th, so the last weekend this month. It's at the R.W. Erickson Foundation property out there. This is an annual music festival that they hold. It's called Wasatch Boomer Fest. So really targeting the 70s, 80s genres and eras of music. It is multiple days. You can buy a single-day ticket, a multiple-day ticket. They also offer camping and RV, no hookups, but RV spots as well. So check out our website or theirs to secure your camping and or your music festival ticket for that. And then the two races I mentioned, One is the Ragnar series, which has been around for quite some time. They've also recently introduced, well, they've had the trail series for a while as well. They've done it and focused in the southern part of the state. This year, they're introducing the trail series for northern Utah, and they're doing it at Soldier Hollow. It'll be that same weekend, August 28th and 29th. It is a team-based race. You would camp out essentially at the base of Soldier Hollow, and then a team member is always on course over that time frame of about, well, it depends on how fast your team runs, but anywhere from about 15 to you know, over 24-hour time frame. So really great opportunity to either come and check out the runners that are going to be on course, or if you yourself want to run, make sure you're signed up for that. The other race will be an all-road gravel race, so bike race, called the Wasatch All-Road Gravel Race. It's going to be held on Saturday, August 29th. There are, I believe, three distances offered for that. One is the full race, the longest distance, and that's considered the Yeti of the race. Kicks off at 8 a.m. and happens on the gravel roads surrounding Wasatch County and beyond. So great opportunity to, if you're going to compete, hats off to you, because it's a pretty grueling, can be pretty intense race. But if you'd like to either volunteer or just cheer on the racers and riders, then join us that morning. And then to wrap it all, of course, we've got the return of the Midway Swiss Days Festival. Every Labor Day weekend, this festival returns to the Midway area, Midway Town Square. It's always held on the Friday and Saturday of Labor Day weekend. Labor Day comes a little later this year, so that's going to be September 4th and 5th. The festival itself is 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. both days. It is free to walk through. There will be close to 180 artisan vendors on Midway Town Square. And what's really unique is over the years, due to, you know, large popularity of visitation that comes into the valley, we get tens of thousands of visitors that come in during those 2 days. The surrounding retail spaces and restaurants sell their front Main Street facing lawn space to additional vendors that maybe didn't get into the Swiss Days Festival for that year. And that allows the retail experience to expand by another 30 shops. So you've got over 200 shops and different booths that you can walk through during Swiss Days. And that's just the beginning of it. Of course, there's live music happening both days that's free. There's food booths set up. A lot of them are Swiss influenced foods and kind of fair style foods. So, you know, you're looking at Navajo tacos, or what they call Swiss tacos, which is the deep fried kind of stone bread topped with jam and honey and butter, all the good things that you're looking for. Saturday has a 10K race, a parade, and a barbecue dinner starting at 4 p.m. on Saturday. Super family friendly. Parking gets to be a little intense. Mm-hmm. So we do have two designated parking lots. They are both marked on the map on either the Swiss Days Festival website or on our website. We do encourage people to carpool, park and bike in if you can, or use those complimentary parking lots. And then a shuttle runs every 10 to 15 minutes to bring people to and from the town square. So, well, plan accordingly if you're going to be in Midway.
There's a lot to choose from, and it sounds like a great way to sort of roll out of summer and into the fall.
Yeah, it certainly is. Yeah, lots of activities across the Wasatch Back between Park City and Heber and Midway. There's always something to do. So.
And it looks like from the note you sent over that it's been a summer of openings of new businesses in town.
It sure has. You know, we've seen a lot of new businesses come to the Valley, come to Wasatch County. And I just wanted to share a few highlights of those. Up at Sky Ridge, which is located across from Deer Valley East Village, essentially, closer to that Jordan L side, so the east of Highway 40, is the Sky Ridge development. Of course, homes still going in up there, being constructed, many of them completed. But the new Par 1 golf course is now open. It actually opened May 25th of this year. There is the golf course itself, which is a three-hole course, but the way that it's structured is you could actually play nine on those three holes because of the distances and the cup sizes and how that changes across the course. Beautiful views of Jordan L Reservoir. They've also got golf bays that are going to be opening in the fall of this year. So we don't have an exact date, opening date yet for those, but they're trying to squeeze those in before winter weather starts this year to get some play on those. They will have full food and beverage. The golf clubhouse itself will have two restaurants, one called Jack's, which will be upscale pub cuisine. The other one will be a provision store offering grab and go and simpler items. So we're looking forward to that clubhouse being completed and getting open. Hopefully the fall of this year may end up leading into the spring of next year. Jordan L. Ridge is another newer residential development area that's happening on the northeast quadrant of Wasatch County and northeast corner of Heber City. Earlier this year on June 20th, they opened their barn and cafe, and this is open to the public. It offers breakfast, lunch, and pizza, great grab and go or pop in and sit for casual bites. We've got a new Thai restaurant that opened in June of this year called Nom Nom Thai. They are located on the south end of Heber City, just right off Main Street in Heber City. Wonderful local family owns that restaurant. Certainly with any new opening of a restaurant location, they're ironing out some of the kinks as they get underway, but really fortunate to have some diversity in the cuisine offerings here throughout the county. We've also got a new ice cream business July 18th, Brooker's Founding Flavors Ice Cream opened on the north end of town right in the New Smith parking lot. And boy, was it well received. They had a line wrapping around the building for the entirety of their opening day.
Yeah, we actually drove through there and saw it. We're kind of running out of time, so I'm going to let you go. Everybody can check out the Chamber website for more information about all the great events. Thanks so much, Jessica. That's Jessica Turner from the Heber Valley Chamber. You've been listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW Radio. Just a quick reminder to stay tuned throughout the day for updates on the Rocky Canyon fire. We should be having new information from officials soon this morning.